Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Today we hear about E.W. Marlin, a man whose life would make a great movie, an Oklahoma oil man who built and lost two fortunes in oil, a man of extravagant taste that built the largest private residence in our state, the Marlin Mansion in Ponca City, but was a progressive businessman who even by today's standards treated his employees extremely well with incredible benefits. A former congressman and governor who launched the New Deal in Oklahoma during the height of the Depression, he even had a scandal. He annulled the adoption of his adopted daughter and married her, his second wife, Lydie Roberts. Well, apparently Hollywood is developing a film about him with the typical Hollywood liberties with the truth, so the E.W. Marlin Foundation wanted to create a documentary that would tell a more authentic version of his life. So they approached my guests today, Scott Swearingen and Steve Herron of Swearingen Productions here in Tulsa, the creator of award-winning documentaries on Woody Guthrie, Thomas Gilcrease, and Willard Stone, to create a project about E.W. Marlin. The result is High Stakes, The Life and Times of E.W. Marlin, which will have its Tulsa premiere tonight at 7:30 at the Circle Cinema. The film premiered in Ponca City this past weekend. And they join us today to talk about the film. Scott and Steve, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks, Rich.
How did this documentary get started, telling the story of E.W. Marlin? Scott, tell us how this went.
I think for me, like a lot of people, if you go to Ponca City and you go to the Marlin Mansion, which is still the largest private residence in the state of Oklahoma, it's 43,500 square feet. It's huge. And you look at the gold leaf ceiling and the, you know, the marble and the chandeliers and on, and you think, why did this happen? Who did this? Uh-huh. You know, why Ponca City? So it got me very curious about Marlin, about the kind of person that could afford to do this and would do this. You know, there had been some shorter documentaries made about Marlin, but nothing that we felt like really told the comprehensive story, because it's really the story of Oklahoma from statehood all the way through the end of the Depression, mm-hmm. and then actually on beyond with Lydie Marlin. So it was curiosity about the man. Who was he? Why did he do this? How could he do this?
I guess the E.W. Marlin Foundation, who administer the home today, they wanted to tell this story. Why did they want to tell the story, particularly today?
Well, there had been talk of a major motion picture involving E.W. Marlin and Lydie Marlin. Lydie was his adopted daughter, later annulled adoption, and later his wife, and incidentally, the First Lady of Oklahoma. So, you know, that's great movie material. And Jennifer Lawrence was talked about as, you know, playing Lydie. So, Steve, you were thinking
that? Well, I think what really motivated the foundation to look at doing this was they got a script, an early version of the script, and it was fictionalized, to say the least. They had actually kind of turned things around. And our understanding was that it picked up towards the end of E.W.'s life, and that Lydie was going to assume control of the company and run the company. And she was the one that was going to receive credit for introducing the benefit packages and all the things that Marlin did for his employees in the city of Ponca City. So they were really concerned about telling the story correctly. And I think that's what really got it started.
Now, it sounds like that was probably one of the first things that probably surprised you, given the fact that E.W. Marlin has the largest home in the state of Oklahoma, 42,000 square feet. You would expect a certain type of individual to live in that home. But in fact, he sounds like he was rather progressive.
Very much. Right. There's so many surprising things about Marlin when you start digging back into his childhood and his traditions. He was actually sent as a young boy to a school called Rugby, which was an experimental, quote, socialistic school in Tennessee. And his father wanted to make sure that E.W. understood the responsibilities of wealth, that it simply wasn't enough to make a lot of money, that your good fortune should be shared with the community and your workers. And so Marlin did amazing things. This is in the teens, in the 1920s.
This is before the New Deal, right?
Yes, before the New Deal. Health insurance, free medical care, life insurance, pension. Low-interest loans to build a home in Ponca City, free advanced education at the Marlin Institute, and what he called a saving wage. He said people need to have a saving wage, not just a living wage. Well, that's radical today. And Marlin did all that. So he was way ahead of his time. And then, you know, we'll talk later about his record as governor during the depths of the Depression, bringing the New Deal to Oklahoma, and all the things that are still here in this state because of Marlin.
Hmm. So I guess the foundation approached you about doing a film. So where did the two of you begin as far as wanting to tell that story? Was it just learning about his life? What beyond this sort of very progressive mindset that he had, what was most interesting about him?
Well, I think Scott just pointed out, to me, one of the things that really stood out was what he did for his employees and for the people of Ponca City. When you look at especially some photographs of Ponca City in 1910, and then you look 10 years later, and the explosion and the growth of that city, and it can really all be credited to Marlin. And he also brought other things to the city, not just this ethic of taking care of the employees, but he introduced polo, fox hunting. He brought a certain cultural influence that people in the plains, you know, they just had never seen before. Again, he was really responsible for, I think, a lot of what Ponca City is today.
You know, for people who aren't longtime Tulsans, they forget, like, you know, out at Southern Hills, the new nine that they did next to Lewis, that used to be the polo fields. I mean, polo was, it was kind of hard to think of a polo existing outside of maybe Beverly Hills or the Hamptons, but that was the mindset of these oil men of the time.
Yeah, it was a sport, too, that was played a lot more, like, as you said, it was played, a lot of the military bases had polo teams, and
Will
so
Rogers
it was a much bigger sport.
That's right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, just by the by, you know, John Duncan Forsyth, the guy who designed Southern Hills, also designed Marlin's home, the mansion. So there's lots of architectural tie-ins back and forth between Tulsa and Ponca City. In fact, we read about Waite Phillips, and when he did Philbrook in 1926, they opened it up, and Marlin was invited to this, you know, 400 of my best friends kind of gala party. And Marlin looked around and thought, I can do better than this.
Yeah, there was definitely a little one-upsmanship there going on.
So, you know, Waite Phillips spends $1.25 million or so on Philbrook, and Marlin says, no, I want to spend $5.5 million on my mansion. So that's done in 1928.
Yeah. Now, you were talking about the impact on Ponca City. I guess Ponca City had oil around. When I think of Ponca City, I also think of the 101 Ranch. Mm-hmm. South of there, were these influences on why Marlin was there?
He had a nephew, Kenny, who knew the brothers. He knew the Miller brothers, and he provided the introduction. So Marlin came from Pennsylvania, was introduced. They struck a deal, formed a company, formed actually several companies, and they started drilling.
So this is 1908.
In 1908,
just 1 year after statehood,
mm-hmm. And. They struck gas in several of the wells, but after 10, they hadn't struck oil. And most of the leases that they were drilling on were on the Miller's lands that they had probably – either they owned outright or they had leased from the Ponca tribe. And the well that he struck, he finally struck oil, the Willie Cries, was leased by a Ponca Indian, Willie Cries for War, and the Millers helped him negotiate that deal. So there was a very strong tie with 101.
And there was this idea that there was no oil west of the Arkansas River in Osage County. You know how it comes
mm-hmm,
down?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That and Marlin disproved that in spades. He after Willie Cries, he went on to we list all the oil fields that he discovered.
I assume there's some in Kansas, some in western Oklahoma, all
then
throughout
he,
the state.
I mean the. So he just discovered oil. Well, we have a slogan that his rival said he had a nose for oil and the luck of the devil.
So as you began investigating the story, what were the sort of the incidents that you wanted to highlight in this film?
Well, as Scott discussed earlier, I think the influence his father had was really important in building his company and, of course, the relationships he had with his employees and that was the first thing that really, really stuck out to me. But I think at the end of the day, it was really his never give up attitude. And he was knocked down so many times, but he always got back up.
Apparently had two fortunes and lost both, right?
Yeah. He was a millionaire in Pittsburgh, and then there was a bank crisis in 1907, actually, he lost everything.
So he came back to Oklahoma.
He's coming to Oklahoma with a letter of credit and a gift of gab, and that's really all he has, you know. So we start – I took actually a motto from Michael Wright, you know, that teaches screenwriting here, and he said, look, start in the middle and end early. So we start in the middle. We start right where Marland is up against it. He is out of money. He's got one last well, and this – if he doesn't strike this – if this well isn't successful, he's out of business. And that's the Willie Cries well. So that's where we start in June 1911. Then we, as Steve said, we show some incidents from his childhood where one is where he's playing marbles as an 8-9-year-old, and Marlon liked to win all the marbles. And so we show him cleaning up a marbles game with some other toe-headed kids. We show him becoming an expert poker player in law school. He goes to law school when he's 17 at the University of Michigan, graduates in 2 years, and somehow plays a lot of poker. That's where we get the high stakes, this idea of the thrill of risk, of the gamble. And I think that's what typified Marland his entire life. He was always very aggressive on taking a chance.
Now, you're creating this reenacted documentary. What are the things you have to keep in mind when you're doing a reenactment documentary as opposed to using pictures and films, old films and things like that? I assume you use those sorts of things as well in the film.
Yeah, sure. You know, of course, we're concerned about accuracy for the time, and we did take some liberty. There's a scene where he introduces Lighty as his new wife. There's a party at the mansion. And we're not sure that he actually threw a party on that scale. He did have a reception, we believe, that introducing Lighty as his wife back in Ponca City. And they quickly found out that it was a little bit of a scandal. And they had to disappear for a little while to escape the heat. But, you know, as far as the reenactments, again, we wanted to be as accurate as possible, but we wanted to try to tell that story. As Scott was describing earlier, the marble game, and then the poker game, kind of building up to that that idea of him as a gambler. And we had quotes from Marlon, and that's what he talked about all the time, is that was his thrill. All the things that he acquired by, you know, accumulating that wealth didn't really mean that much to him. And some people would say, oh, come on, he built this huge mansion and seemed to be a little extravagant at times, and that's true. But he ultimately, that was what was really – and turned him on. I mean, that's what he really enjoyed, was the thrill of the hunt.
And we were really lucky to be working in Ponca City because the community embraced this project. So when the party scene, like there's 100 people there all dressed up in 1920s things, the local tuxedo store helped us with 1920s style tuxedos. We had Ponca City little kids on the marble game. Mm-hmm. We had TU drama students at the poker table for that enactment. So in an interesting way, it was a chance for Ponca City to act out its history, almost its founding myth, if you will. We found that a lot of people had forgotten Marlon, didn't know who he was.
Just a big house over there on one of the roads, yeah.
Some guy, yeah. You know. Uh-huh. And they had no idea that what he had brought to that community, what he did for the oil industry, and how far-thinking he was, and also what he did as governor, which is he took over as governor during the worst part of the Depression in Oklahoma. He wanted to bring the New Deal and the jobs of the New Deal to Oklahoma, and he ended up with 7 state parks are his. Yeah. The dam, the Pensacola Dam that forms Grand Lake. Everybody who goes up on the weekend to Grand Lake needs to tip their hat to Marlon because he made that dam happen and all the electricity and the power to rural Oklahoma and the highway patrol. So he was an incredibly progressive guy who, just like now, was going butting heads with a very obstinate legislature.
Yeah, in fact, he was a one-term governor,
yes,
right?
He was one term.
Right? Yeah. Was that because he lost re-election or—
He wanted to run for Senate. He felt like he could do more in Senate. He had been at Congress for one term, and he was elected in 32, and he felt like he could do more as senator, but he was defeated. He'd made a lot of enemies when he was in Congress, and so he ran for Senate twice, was defeated both times, and then he dies in 1941.
And so I think he also had, as governor, he had some issues that it wasn't like running your own company. He had the legislature to deal with.
Ross Perot.
He found that a little bit cumbersome.
My guests today are Scott Swearingen and Steve Herron, the producers of High Stakes, The Life and Times of E.W. Marlin. It has its Tulsa premiere tonight at 7:30 at the Circle Cinema. And they're our guests today on Studio Tulsa. They had their premiere last Friday in Ponca City.
Yeah.
How did that go over in Ponca City?
What a blowout. God,
it was a lot of fun.
Have you ever been to the Ponca Theater?
The Ponca Theater, yeah, it's a beautiful theater.
1926, one of those big movie palaces, holds a little over 800 people. They filled that theater. I've never, I've shown my work maybe to 50 people, maybe 100 people, but not 800 people. It was an incredible night.
Yeah, and I assume the Marlin Foundation very happy with what you've done. Are they going to use that as a part of sort of telling the story of, at least a part of the film is telling the story of Marlin at the mansion?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was one of the initial things. They wanted some storytelling at the Grand Home, which is the house that Marlin lived in the most, and then also at the mansion. So what we've done is we've cut down excerpts. The final film is 57 minutes long. So what we've done is cut down two short pieces, one for the Grand Home and one for the mansion. So when people visit, they'll get a sampling of the larger film.
Now, one of the things you did is this was sort of on a grander scale than a lot of these sorts of documentaries have. You have an original film score. I mean, you kind of did a lot more than you would usually do for a film that will have some showings and then it goes to become a museum piece.
Yeah, we very quickly, when we first thought about this story, we thought we could tell it in a half hour, and very quickly found you can't to do it justice. It's at least an hour. And then we really jumped in over our heads when we thought, okay, well, let's have some original music, not use just canned music that you can buy off the internet. And we heard of Joseph Rivers, who did a piece, a symphonic piece, that had a Marlin, an EW theme, and a Leidy theme. So we thought, well, maybe this is, maybe he could do something for this film. And we worked with Joseph, and he was really great to work with. I mean, at first, we just weren't on the same page about the kind of music we wanted and all that. But we just went back and forth, and he kept revising and I think it turned out to be really, really wonderful music that really underscores the emotions of the piece.
And were there other things that you did in the film that you might not necessarily do for a documentary on this scale?
Well, the reenactments.
Yeah.
Scott came up with that, and at first, again, I was thinking more of a traditional type of documentary.
Ken Burns, take the picture
and
move it across the screen.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But when Scott proposed that to me and started thinking about it, of course it intrigued me because I love the production aspect of it, and I knew it would really bring it to life. And it does. Those scenes breaking up the pictures give you food for thought and sort of why he did these things.
And you move back and forth between documentary footage, whether it be newsreels or still photographs.
Yeah.
And we have very limited there's very limited footage of Marlin. We have a little bit of his inauguration. And then he did a speech that was – there was oil underneath the Capitol. Anybody who's been to the Oklahoma State Capitol knows they see the derricks. Well, that's thanks to Marlin because Marlin called out the militia and secured that property for the state of Oklahoma.
Now, was Marlin the governor that sort of basically sent the troops to all the oil fields to basically stop production?
Or was that his predecessor.
Predecessor.
Alfalfa Bill Murray.
Right, right.
Who was a totally different – political animal than Marlin.
Yeah, and so Marlin was working within the federal system to sort of bring patronage of the New Deal to Oklahoma.
Yeah,
and I would assume that even in those times, it engendered quite a bit of controversy.
Yeah, it did. See, Murray, Alfalfa Bill, didn't want to accept any federal dollars unless it had no strings. In other words, you send me the money, I'll spend it how I want, okay? Mm-hmm. And, of course, you know, the feds didn't want to do that. So Marlin said, you send me the money and I'll use my business experience and my experience in Congress, my credibility, to make sure that money is spent wisely. And that's why we have seven state parks, like Osage Hills, if you go up there.
Mm-hmm. It's
all
WPA.
All that brickwork and all that, that's all CCCWPA. That's all mm-hmm. Marlin. You know, so it was just a real turning point for the state because there was so much unemployment and so much hunger and so much misery. And this was also in the middle of the Dust Bowl.
And also oil prices were right. down in the can. And that's what eventually did Marlin in, I think, really, because he was caught up in the Depression in his own personal fortune, wasn't he?
There were a lot of factors. Mm-hmm. J.P. Morgan Jr. being the primary one that really caused his downfall. Marlin wanted to expand. He controlled about 10% of the world's oil, and everything was great, going well, couldn't ask for it to be better. But he was having to go to regional banks, and he was borrowing from several different banks, and he wanted to kind of consolidate. So J.P. Morgan Jr. invited him to lunch and said, we can take care of all your needs, your financial needs. We will back you. And so they had different – they talked about different – approaches, and the one they finally settled on was Morgan buying $12 million of Marlin Oil stock. But it came with a caveat, and that was, we want three seats on your board. And that was the beginning of the end.
And so he basically lost control of his own company?
He lost control of his own company.
It was a hostile takeover, yeah, we would call it these
But days. So you have that, and you also have the price of oil dropping. Demand is dropping. There's a flood of oil hitting the market. Some big discoveries are made in Texas. And so it was just really the perfect storm. It really was that created his downfall.
Now, do you spend much time on the relationship between E.W. Marlin and his adoptive daughter who becomes his wife, Lydie?
Yes.
Do you spend a lot of time on that relationship?
Yeah.
It sounds like that would be a, you know, by today's standards, that would be a sort of a disqualifying scandal, you know, to be a politician.
Yeah. Well, I think it's important to say that Lydie and George, first of all, a brother and sister were adopted together. They were not blood relations of Marlin.
Right.
They were the children of Marlin's first wife's sister. And that family had fallen on hard times, and the Marlins didn't have children. And so it got to be like, well, you know, how about some of the older kids coming to live with your aunt and uncle? So we had people speculate why the marriage. Why did that happen? And I think we come to the fact that we don't know.
Biographers don't know?
We just don't know.
Yeah.
Because, well, John Joseph Matthews, who writes, you know, Life and Death of an Oil Man, Lydie gets one sentence in that book. Boom, that's it. He does not go into it at all. We don't know what happened, although we can say that one of our interviews with a Lydie's lawyer, a man, C.D. Northcutt, who's now in his mid-90s, Lydie calls him up towards the end of her life and says, I want you to come up here because I want to tell you something, but I don't want you to tell anybody until I'm gone. C.D. goes up there and she said, E.W. told me once he loved me more than anything else in the whole world. Well, to me, that's not the statement of a person who was abused.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there was something else going on. There was a either wanting to take care of her to preserve the fortune, much of, you know, there wasn't much left, but preserve that, or just to, you know, as David Keithley says, maybe they just fell in love.
Yeah. Now, despite that scandal when he married her, he did become governor after they were married, correct?
Right. Yeah. She was the first lady. A very glamorous first lady, by the way.
Yeah. And after he died, she represented the family, I assume, for a number of years.
In a way. In a way. That's another very rocky part of the story. She Marlin dies in 41. George moves to Tulsa to start over. Lydie stays in Ponca City, kind of out of sorts, unable to figure out where she fits now that E.W. is gone. And in 1953, she packs up some art and some money, gets in a car and drives away, and is not heard of for 22 years.
Wow.
Her brother actually contacted the FBI, and they couldn't find her either. And he died without ever knowing what happened to his sister.
That's an amazing story.
Really poignant story. And then she's founded.
In fact, the grounds of the house became like a convent for a while.
Sold to the Carmelite order. Uh-huh. And I think they were only in it for about 4 or 5 years. And then sold it to the Felician sisters, who controlled it for about 20 years.
Yeah. And then, luckily, the city of Ponca City, they did a bond issue. They actually raised sales taxes, went half and half with Conoco, and bought the mansion, and earlier had bought the grand home. So there was talk of scraping the mansion and just putting some more houses there. I mean, it's a nice piece of property.
Mm-hmm.
So that we have that still to go to is, I mean, really a remarkable story in and of itself.
Yeah. Now, Scott, you've been telling a lot of stories about Oklahoma history. Was this perhaps the most fascinating you've gotten into yet?
Yeah, this is the best project I've ever worked on. We had the resources to do the research necessary. There are hundreds and hundreds of photographs in this thing. And the resources to do the reenactments. We had the artistic and production talent in Tulsa to be able to do it locally. I think this is an incredible story for Oklahoma. I think it's a story that also relates to our times of overproduction, low oil prices, what can be done. And this is a story of a man who never gave up.
All right.
I just want to add that it was one of the things that was so fascinating to me when Scott first brought the idea to me and we started talking about it. I, like so many Oklahomans, didn't know who E.W. Marlin was. And when some of the things that Scott's done in the past with Gilcrease and others, these are known and still recognized characters in our history. But the Marlin name was forgotten. And that was driven a lot by the fact that when he was forced out of his company, his name was erased from everything.
Yeah, it used to be a Marlin Oil, I believe.
Yes.
Marlin Oil, yeah.
And now it's some version of Conoco.
Right, yeah. And they used the same logo at the time, and they simply painted across the Marlin name and removed it quickly. They restructured the board, essentially got rid of all of his board that were really his employees. That was one of the big criticisms he got from the Morgan people, was that you can't have your employees running the company. And so they just eliminated him. In fact, they offered to keep him on as a figurehead. They said, if you'll step down, you can stay in Ponca City. They wanted him to leave Ponca City. And we'll give you a little stipend, a little salary, if you agree to do that. Because they didn't want him around because the people loved him.
Wow. Well, it sounds like...
And he refuses.
Yeah.
He says, forget it. I'm here.
Yeah.
This is my home.
The name of the film is High Stakes, The Life and Times of E.W. Marlin. Scott and Steve, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Rich.
Steve Herron and Scott Swearingen of Swearingen Productions of Tulsa, the producers of a new documentary on the life of one of Oklahoma's most colorful and controversial oil barons, E.W. Marlin. High Stakes, The Life and Times of E.W. Marlin has its Tulsa premiere at the Circle Cinema this evening at 7:30. For more information, visit CircleCinema.com. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.